Good morning. My name's Beth Hartley. I'm an alcoholic. I have to move all this stuff or I'll play with it the whole time I talk. Through the grace of God and the fellowship and steps of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. And that amazes me, although on this program I'm feeling a bit like the token newcomer. It's really exciting, though, all these people that were my heroes, but it's really rare that I get to be the high-bottom drunk, so good. Maybe I wasn't that bad. We'll see. I want to thank Alan and the committee for asking me. It's always an honor and a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially here because this is one of our favorite conventions. We probably look familiar to you because Chuck and I are here every year. We love this convention, and we come to be one of many most of the time. We just have better seats this year. So, anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I have enjoyed the speakers so far. I can't wait to hear the rest, and I can't wait to be done in about an hour so I can go back to being one of many. You know, Joe said he bounced in and out a little bit, and I was the same way. I did not walk through the doors of AA and go, oh, thank God I'm home, and I want what you have. And, you know, I mean, I did not want what you had. It was looking pretty lame to me. I had actually been to AA meetings at the age of 7 because my father got sober in 1966. I'm 48, so you don't have to do that math. And because that's what I would have been doing. Anyway, my dad got sober when I was 7, and we went to open meetings on Friday nights because my parents, since my dad had been drinking, didn't have a lot of money for sitters and everything. And I was the kid back in the corner with the coloring book at the open meeting in Hamilton, Ohio in 1966. And I knew the AA was all old men that drank coffee and ate donuts and smoked a lot because I had seen it myself. You know, I mean, I would be on the floor coloring, and you come up to table height, and everybody just disappeared because they could smoke indoors back then. And, you know, but these guys were old. I mean, for God's sakes, they're my dad's age and older, and he was, I don't know, 35, 36, 37 years old. And anybody your parents' age is going to die any day when you're 7, you know. So I knew Alcoholics Anonymous existed, and I didn't grow up with drinking in the house. I didn't grow up with chaos in the house. You know, I had a sober parent through most of my childhood, and my mom is not alcoholic. You know, she couldn't prove she had given birth to me. Sometimes I wonder if we're really related because, you know, we're just very different. And my dad told me all the horror of his drinking and the lost dreams and the lost opportunity. And I, you know, the first time I drank, I just really felt bad for him that he had such a hard time. Some people just shouldn't drink, you know. I was an only child. I was an avid reader as a child. I'm sure my first escapes were into books because I read The House Could Crumble Around Me and I wouldn't hear anything. You know, I could just go wherever that book was. That's where I was. And I tell you that for a couple of reasons. One, because, you know, I think that was my first, you can't really do geographical escapes when you're 4 and 5, but, you know, that's as close as I could get. And the other thing is that when I got to school, school came very easily to me, and I think it's because of all the early reading. It wasn't because of any work ethic, I can tell you that, because if it was hard, I just didn't do it. And, you know, but I think what happened as a result of that, or just kind of all in line with that, is that when things weren't easy, I didn't do them, because I just thought everything should come easily to you. You know, I looked at people around me, and everything seemed to come easily to them. They all just seemed to know what to do. And I always felt like I was gone the day they handed out the directions. And, you know, you've heard it said over and over and over in here. I didn't know I was a big thinker. When I got here, I didn't really identify. You know, when I was bouncing in and out, I heard that self-centeredness was our problem. And I really didn't get that because I was the most giving, kind, unselfish person I knew. Just ask me. And plus, I thought that selfishness, I thought that meant taking the biggest cookie. You know, I mean, I thought that meant just keeping for myself. And I didn't look up selfish in a dictionary till I was 10 years sober. And the dictionary says selfish means being totally consumed with oneself, often to the exclusion of all others. And I thought, well, I'll be darned. Okay, maybe I'm a little, maybe just a little. But we always lived next door to big families full of kids, and so I would just spend all my time over there. Because at a very early age, I could not sit alone in a room with myself. At an early age, there was a lot of chatter in my head. There were a lot of people up there, and none of them liked me, you know. And so what they would tell me when I was alone was that you just played with me because you had to. You didn't really like me. You were talking about me when I wasn't there. You know, you saw me fall down playing kickball and you're still laughing at it. Whatever. I didn't know that's what self-centered meant. I didn't know that self-centered meant that I am so consumed with what you think of me that I don't even know who I am without that. And that I had to spend all of my time appearing some way to you just so I could be comfortable. And when I got here and read the big book and it said, you know, we do this inventory and we find out that the world and its people dominated us, I didn't really understand that because when I got here, I had my own Harley Davidson. I drank with big, huge guys in black leather jackets. You know, nobody messed with me. I never fought. Now, the reason I didn't fight, I always have to clarify that, I didn't fight for two reasons. One, I had a huge fear of getting humiliated in public. I knew if I hit you once, you would hit me back and it would hurt and I'd look bad. And the other thing is, I mean, you know, let's face it, when fights break out, drinks get spilled. And, you know, there's always some idiot in the bar swinging and tables go over and pitchers of beer are just gone forever. And I just couldn't bear the thought of that. So I didn't fight, but I looked like I would fight. And I guess that was enough. So that, you know, the only domination I could relate to was a physical domination and nobody pushed me around. And what I've come to understand is what dominated me was what you thought of me. What dominated me was who do I have to be so you will accept me so I can be okay. Because I never felt like I was enough. Even at 5 and 6 years old, I never felt like I took up my space. I had to be huge and do big things and be everywhere and all things to all people just to justify the little space that I took in the earth. And I never, you know, so being Beth was just never enough. And if I felt, you know, if I said my name's Beth, I felt like you were just waiting for the rest. Like, yeah, so what, you know? So I was busy, you know, I was in the middle of everything. I was Beth the cheerleader and I was on student, in junior high school, I was on student council and I was on, you know, honor society and yearbook staff and pep club and you know, I was doing it all. I was just busy, 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 busy. Because I absolutely could not be alone in a quiet room because it was too noisy and it was too unfriendly. You know, one of my favorite promises in the big book is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Because that's a promise that's come true for me, and that's something that I just absolutely did not experience till I got here. And you know that the book talks about drinking's a symptom and that our thinking's off, and like I said, I didn't really see that until my kids started getting older. When I got sober, my kids were 4 and 6, and they weren't in my custody. But I would have told you I have a son's older, daughter's younger, and we would have told you, you know, by the time she was 6 or 7, we would have told you she was going to be joining us any day. You know, I mean, she just had that gleam in her eye, and she could lie and just not miss a beat, you know. And just, you know, Chuck and I used to tell people, you know, a lot of people save for college, we're saving for treatment. And, so when she was 11, she wanted to be on a swim team. A lot of her friends were swimming. And so we took her over to try out for the team. And the coach said, well, you could be on the team, but you need to practice down in age group because you can't keep up with your age group. Well, you know, that means at 11, he wanted her to swim with the 9-year-olds at practice. I could not have done that at 11 years old. How's that going to look? You know, now I was 7 years sober when he told her this, and I was having a little trouble being the mom of the 11-year-old that wanted to swim with the 9-year-olds. But it was okay with her. She practiced down in age group, you know, and she went to her first swim meet, and these were big USS teams, so they just run the heats and post the results. And she was 70th out of 72 in her first race, and she went back the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. And we told her, okay, Sarah, you didn't win, but, you know, but you got baseline time now. And next time you race, even if you don't win that race, If you beat your time, you've had a successful race. You know, I mean, my parents told me that stuff. I never believed it. That's just the stuff you're supposed to tell your kids, you know. But she beat her time, and she was happy. And the rest of that story is that 2 years later, she was a state AA swimmer, you know, and she swam all over the Midwest. We lived in Cincinnati, and she swam all over the Midwest. I mean, Lexington and Indianapolis, and all. We would drive for hours to go to swim meets. And I would have missed every bit of that the day they told me to practice with the nine-year-olds. I couldn't have done it because it would have made me look so bad to have to swim with the younger kids. And somewhere along the line, I realized that, you know, we're wondering, I wonder if this is what normal thinking looks like. I mean, you know, how would we know? But we thought, you know, Sarah somehow internalized that message that everybody tries to teach us about set a goal, work for the goal, achieve the goal. You know, that's clearly what she was doing. Now, my outlook on life has always been just give me the goal, for God's sakes, you know? I deserve it. So we started watching her with interest because, you know, this was taking a turn that we weren't expecting. And through the next few years, she just kept doing weird stuff like that. She had her first summer job, and she saved $500. I mean, who does that, you know? And she had, when she graduated from high school, she had the same group of friends that she had had in first and second grade. You know, I had to change schools twice. And I mean, some days we would just look at her and say, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house. Congratulations. We're pretty sure it's you. And, you know, and I tell that story because at 11 years old, she had never had a drink, but neither had I. You know, I had not had a drink at 11, but we reacted to life so differently. Or maybe she didn't react to life at all. Maybe she just lived life. But I was like the pinball in the pinball machine. I just bounced off whatever direction I hit. And, you know, so I went through school and I'm busy, busy, busy because I can't be alone. And I started to drink in high school when I was 15 years old. And the first time I got drunk, I didn't get real drunk because some of my friends were experimenting and they were falling down, throwing up, looking bad. And I don't like to look bad. You may have gleaned that already. And, you know, but I put a glow on and it was enough. It was enough that I took my best friend out the next night to get her drunk with me so I'd have somebody to drink with. And it was on, you know, from that day, it was on. If I could have gotten it every day, I would have been a daily drinker. And in the first year that I drank, that list that they give Al-Anon people sometimes about, is your child doing this? I mean, I was doing all of it. My friends changed, my grades plunged, every bit of it. But, you know, for whatever reason, I kind of skated on through. And I graduated from high school barely, you know, mostly because I didn't drink the first year, so I had a bunch of credits stacked up. And, you know, the other interesting thing that happened, when I started to drink, I no longer needed all those activities. And that wasn't a conscious thought, you know, but one by one by one, those activities started to fall away. Some of them were taken away from me, you know. They frown on cheerleaders skipping school to go to Green Beer Day. They thought I should not be a cheerleader anymore. And, you know, some of them I gave away, nice boyfriends, you know, stuff. I just, who cares? Take it, you know, because a drink is more important. And some things slid away, and I didn't even know they were gone until I got them back when I got sober. You know, I grew up in a college town. I grew up in Oxford, Ohio, where Miami University is, and I was going to college football games as a 6- and 7-year-old. I mean, I love college sports. And I didn't really know that was gone because I would sit in front of a TV and drink and watch them. But after I was sober, when Chuck got his degree, they sent along a couple of football tickets to University of Cincinnati game, which at the time were about as hard to get as Bengals tickets were in the 90s. And, you know, when people leave them on their windshield and nobody steals them. Hard to be a football fan some years. Anyway, you know, we went to this college game, and I guess I was 92, so I must have been 4 years sober. And, you know, the band's warming up, and the cheerleaders are running around, and, you know, it's just like the pre-football game stuff. And all of a sudden, I realized I was standing there with tears rolling down my cheeks, because here was a whole piece of my life back that I didn't even know was gone. You know, and that's one of the huge things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You hear over and over and over and over, if you made a list when you got here of what you wanted, it would be so short of what we get here. You know, I could not have dreamed this big. There's no way. I just couldn't have dreamed this big. I mean, my list when I got here was, I would really like my driver's license back. I would really like to stop getting arrested. I perhaps would like to have another relationship with a man, preferably one that had a job. You know, because those aren't the kind of questions you ask at last call, you know, could I see your employment history? That's how I dated. You know, if they're still there 2 days later, it's a relationship. And, I mean, Chuck and I had to learn how to date in AA. Neither one of us had a clue. I got to AA and my sponsor said, Beth, dating and sex are not the same. Now, who knew that, you know? I thought that's what you started with. And so we made the decision to keep our clothes on when we started to date and we got to know each other. And, you know, AA dating, I mean, you have coffee before the meeting or you have coffee after the meeting. And when you go home, you're not sure whether you should kiss goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. And, we did both. Anyway, I was off and running, and I could drink a lot from the beginning. I mean, I had a huge capacity for alcohol. I was very proud of that. Plus, you know, I was less apt to fall down, throw up, and look bad. And I drank with the guys because I could. You know, one of the things that horrified me when I got here was when they said hang out with the women. I just thought, you've got to be kidding me. I didn't even drink with women. Why do I want to hang out with them sober, you know? I mean, because drinking, you know, with the girls in high school, they're girls, you know? I mean, they would giggle or fall down or throw up, and some of them would wear pink in public, and that was so embarrassing. And, you know, we all liked the same guy. It was just complicated, and you get a little older, and it's still complicated, but now you have complications like, oh, that was your husband, you know? Could happen to anybody. Don't ask those questions at last call either. And so anyway, the drinking progressed, and I got through high school, and I went off to college, and I flunked out of college because it's, you know, they say it's helpful if you go to meetings, you know, while you're doing AA. I guess it's helpful if you go to class while you're in college. And but I wasn't doing a lot of drinking there because I had not done my homework, and I went off to Indiana University as a 17-year-old freshman, and it was a 21 state at the time. And it was miles to the nearest state line. And, you know, this is, again, where in hindsight, I know that it was the fear that was running my life. You know, I would not have told you I was afraid when I got here. The only reason I had fear on my inventory, my first one, is because the one in the book had fear, 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 fear. And I figured, all right, if they got it on every one, possibly I have a little, I'll write it down. But I didn't know I was afraid of everything, you know. And what happened was when I would go to class, you know, I have a hard time walking into a room full of people because it splits into two groups, all of you and me. And, you know, and you all know each other and you all have that art of conversation thing that was one of the things I missed the directions to. And so, you know, I don't know what to say after my name's Beth. You know, small talk just eludes me. And so I walk in and I might meet somebody and say, hi, my name's Beth. And she'll say, hey, my name's Debbie. And I know it's my turn to talk, you know. She's waiting for me to say something. And you know, well, now everybody in my head starts up because they're all still, you know, and so they're like, well, say something. You look stupid. Well, don't talk now. You'll look dumber. You've been staring at her 5 minutes. What are you going to say anyway? Did you do your home, you know? They're arguing. I'm paralyzed. We have to go. And so I can't go back there again, you know. So I just, you know, I quit. Well, it's right on the line whether I quit or flunked out. It probably depends on who you talk to. I quit before they threw me out, as I did with many jobs. And I went back to Ohio, you know, thinking I had disgraced my parents in this college town. So I got a, you know, respectable job in a bank. And they work Monday mornings. That just wasn't working for me at all. And a friend of mine said, we should go to Florida. And I said, wow, we should, you know, because I had always wanted out. I'll tell you what, growing up in Ohio was my first resentment. I was born in California. I was supposed to be a California girl. And as a result of my father's drinking, they moved back to Ohio. I don't know if that's just permanent penance or what. It took me years into sobriety to figure out Ohio wasn't my problem. But, you know, as a child, I mean, I can remember being in the first day of first grade looking at a map of the United States and seeing California and Texas and Florida and oceans and water and warm weather and then seeing Ohio. And just, you know, at 6 years old, I'm looking at a map thinking, you could tell looking at a map that nothing is happening in Ohio. Now, where does that come from at 6 years old, you know? But already at 6 years old, if my life was different, I would be happy. If I lived somewhere else, I'd be okay. If my mom was more like the other moms, if I had long hair, I was already looking to everything outside of me to make me feel better because there was nothing inside except a bunch of people that couldn't stand me. And so we took off to Florida. I had been wanting to run away for years. It just, you know, took me a while to get up the momentum to go. And we got down to Florida, and I got a job in a convenience store because I had worked in one in Ohio. And, you know, what I didn't know was Bonita Springs in 1978 was extremely transient, and if you went to work 3 days in a row, you were management material. So by the time I called my mom to tell her where I was assistant manager of this store. Don't worry, Mom, I'm assistant manager. And she said something to me that she said a lot, which was, how can you do something that's stupid and land on your feet? It just made her, she had this crazy idea there should be consequences for your actions. And, you know, I just was like that guy wandering through life with the pianos and the safes crashing behind him. You know, I would have consequences periodically, but never what they should have been. The only time I ever got suspended from school, it snowed and there was no school, you know, so my record's clean. But that's the kind of goofy stuff that happened to me all the time. So I called her and said, I'm in Florida, I'm working here. And she said, well, why didn't you just tell us, you know, that you were leaving? And I'm thinking, hello, I ran away from home. It's not the kind of thing that you announce. And duh. She said, Beth, you're 19. You could have just left. And I was like, oh, God, who knew that? You know, I stand before you as a 19-year-old runaway. And just the first time I could get up the momentum to get out of the house. And, you know, I loved Florida. When I got to Florida, those were my people. This town was 3 miles long, and we bought beer on this end of town to drink on the way to the bar on this end of town. Those are my kind of people. And, you know, like I said, I knew I'd be better in Florida or better anywhere. And I had, when I was new in Cincinnati, a guy commented one day that really Florida, California, and Arizona should just have a sign at the state line that says, this state doesn't work either. A lot of us Midwesterners could just turn around and go back home. And so, you know, I was in Florida 6 years, and this is where I met the practice husband. My sponsor says I have to call him a nice name, so that's all I got. But, you know, I met him with my usual dating methodology, last call, and one of the principles that I lived by was never, ever, ever, ever tell anyone that you have made a mistake. You know, don't admit in public that you're wrong. So, you know, this last call thing stretched into a 5-year marriage because I wasn't going to admit that I made a mistake, and apparently neither was he. So, you know, we just kind of went on our merry way, and we had the 2 kids, and we lived in the Keys for a while, and I loved the Keys. Those were my people, too, you know. And it was just, when Bill Wilson talks about I had arrived, I know what he meant. Because at 23 years old, I had a little golden-haired blonde baby. It was a skinny year, you know. I'm hanging out on the beach. Some of us who've been, you know, we know which years are which. And But, you know, I'm working at this oceanfront resort in the Keys. I became their night auditor. Oh, and the move was the same kind of thing. We went to the Keys 4th of July weekend. We came back Tuesday, moved on Friday with a baby and $400 because we liked it, you know. Hey, Mom, move to the Keys, but don't worry, I'm assistant manager at this restaurant, you know. And I became the night auditor at this oceanfront resort, which was just, you know, I mean, they doubled my pay, and then I found out that one of the things the night auditor did was ring out every so I had the keys to every, there were 7 bars and 3 restaurants on this property, and I had the keys to all of them, and they paid me. You know, it was just a wonderful, wonderful place. I think everybody who worked there is either NAA, in prison, or dead. I mean, you know, Nobody runs a business like that, but there we were. And, you know, it was expensive living in the Keys. We started a little home-based business on the side. And, you know, don't get ahead of me. A few other entrepreneurs in here. Yeah. So, you know, it was there was a lot of importing and exporting going on down there. We opened up a local distributorship, and I mean, I really thought of it as a part-time job, but after the arrest, when I tried to explain that to the probation officer, she told me that Monroe County thought of it as sale of a controlled substance. So, you know, that was the first trouble I got into I thought I might not get out of. But even that, it kind of turned out okay, and they really thought that he was my problem. He was a little older, and they thought it was probably all his fault that we were dealing in outside issues. And I'm not going to tell him different. I'm thinking, no, I'm the accountant. He's too stupid. We'd be broke. But, you know, that's not the kind of thing you tell your PO. I just nodded and tried to look innocent. And I ended up finally got the divorce, you know, because I wanted out so badly, but I just couldn't be the one. It had to be his fault. So I just drank until he threw me out, you know, and that's what I was looking for. And when he said get out, he didn't have to ask twice. I was on the phone the next morning to my mom saying, send us a plane ticket. He finally threw me out. And I was happy about that because I wanted out, but now it's his fault. You know, it's his fault the marriage is over. It's not my fault. Because my deal has always been, I want to make it your problem to see that I get done what I need to do. You know, and I ended up back in Ohio in 1984 with a two-year-old and a baby. And I tried AA. You know, I went to AA once in 1983 in the Keys because I got fired from that great job because I had gone to happy hour at 5 and I was still there at 11 when I was supposed to clock in. And so I went to the Key Largo Tuesday night meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1983. And, you know, I mean, I had been to AA as a kid with my dad, but and periodically I would go home and visit, and he would invite me to a meeting. Don't know why. And, you know, I would go with him, and they'd go around and introduce themselves, and I'd say, my name's Beth. I'm with him. And, you know, because one thing, and children of sober alcoholics will understand this. You know, I've heard people say that they sit in bars sometimes, and they would say, oh, I'm alcoholic. Who cares, you know? Well, when you're the child of a sober alcoholic, you can't say that A word out loud in the same sentence with your name because the big book will drop out of the sky and somebody will hand you a meeting schedule, you know? I never wondered if I was alcoholic, but I went to this AA meeting in Key Largo. I'm 24 years old. It was very nice. It was one of those discussion meetings where they all related to each other and they were very kind, and they invited me to Perkins after the meeting. I am 24 years old in my black leather jacket. It is 9:30 at night, and I have just been invited to Perkins. My life is over. But, back in the spirit of the pianos and safes, I went to my boss and told him I knew I had a problem. I was going to AA, and they gave me my job back. So one AA meeting, and I am back to work. This AA stuff is awesome. And I think I went to the Friday night Key Largo meeting and told them I got my job back, and that was pretty much the end of my Keys AA career. But I had called my dad after the first meeting and told him that I had said I was an alcoholic out loud, you know, because it was the first time I ever said it out loud was at that meeting. And within a week, I got a box from him. And it had a big book and a 12 and 12 and a one day at a time, and each day a new beginning, and a 24-hour day book, and a tape of his talk, and a couple of bookmarks. You know, I don't know how many years he had been filling that box up, you know. Few of us have boxes going for our kids. And, you know, I mean, it was in the mail. So I had the information, and I moved back to Ohio, and I thought, okay, I will try AA again. Maybe, you know, I'm drinking a little too much. So in 1984, when I moved back to Cincinnati, Young People's, because, you know, I'm still only 25, and Young People's was huge in Cincinnati in the mid-80s. The Monday night meeting was 200 people strong, and Friday Night Live was 150 people, and Icky Paw had just been there the year before, and they were on fire. But, you know, when I walk into a room, it separates all of you and me, and I don't know what to say after my name's Beth. And I don't want to be new, for God's sakes, because my other rule that I live by besides, you know, never say you're wrong, is that it's not all right not to know. You know, I mean, I was doing fake it till you make it long before I got around here, because I can't ask a question, because if I ask a question, you know I don't know. and that is not acceptable. I must appear at all times like I know what's going on, you know? And so you guys all knew each other, and you're all talking about the AA stuff, and, you know, you're very nice, but I would jet in right before the meeting and, you know, take off the second it was over, and I don't know. I know I gave it a good 2 weeks. I'm sure of it. You know, but, and I got a sponsor, but she wasn't calling me as often as I thought she should be calling me. You'd think they want you to stay sober, you know, but, and I just went to the bar because I can go to the bar and be fine. I cannot know anybody at the bar and be fine with $5. You know, if I got $5 walking in the door at the end of the night, I know who can drink as much as me and not throw down. I know who can shoot pool as well as me, and I know who knows where the party is after. And I was fine with that, you know, because it was just too hard trying to, you know, I mean, I just couldn't do it. And again, I had no idea that it was fear that was running my life. And by the spring of 1985, my children were removed from my custody because I lived up the street from a bar and I put them to bed one night. They were 1 and 3. I put them to bed and there was nothing to drink and I had to drink. And I went down the street to the bar because they were fine in bed. And my son woke up and he couldn't find me and he came outside and he cried and the neighbor called the police. And the police called me at the bar and said, well, you know, you think you ought to come home? And that was kind of a toss-up, but I figured I probably should. And, you know, and they said, is there anybody we can call to come get your children? Well, I certainly don't want them calling my mother. I'll never hear the end of that, you know. So I said, no, I don't think there is, you know, figuring they go, oh, okay, and leave. And they just said, well, we'll have to call 241-KIDS then. And I went, oh, wait, I think my mother lives here, you know. So my mother got that middle-of-the-night call that no parent wants to get, you know, come get your grandchildren, your daughter's under arrest. And my kids ended up at my mom's for a very long time. I went to treatment because it was suggested that if I went to treatment, I might not go to jail for 6 months, and that seemed like a pretty good plan to me. So I went to treatment. I found one I could afford and found out after I got there that it was all women and 6 weeks long. That was kind of a cruel joke. But, you know, I was the one that people would come to get because, you know, when I got there, I already had my own big book. I had a tape of my dad's talk. I had a Sandy B talk. I was telling somebody this morning. I went to OEPA in 1984. I was so inspired. I stayed sober for, 3 days, I think. And this woman talked, you know, and I thought, well, what the heck? I'll buy another tape. I'd never seen AA convention tapers or anything, so I'd buy another cassette tape, see what she has to say, Sandy B, right? So then I put it in the machine, and boy, was I surprised, but I was already halfway home, so I couldn't take it back. And you know, and I just grew to love that tape. So when I get to treatment, I'm like the experienced day. You know, I've got my own big book. I got my dad's talk. I got Sandy B's talk. You know, because I'm a test taker. I can read something and spit it right back out. You know, I'm one of those people that can never see something, take a look at it, take a test, and not know what I read 4 days later. Which works great in treatment, but it's not real effective in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, so I became, you know, in my own mind at least, the star of treatment. And I was the one that the women, that the counselors would come get to talk to women who didn't want to leave their children for 6 weeks to go to treatment. And, you know, some they were hesitant to leave their kids for that long. And I would tell them all the right stuff, you know, better 6 weeks now than forever later. And if we're not sober, we can't be parents anyway. You know, this is so much better for your children to come in here and get sober. But, you know, there was a problem with that. And the book calls it leading a double life. You know, that we have the one we want the world to see and we have the life we know is true. And what I was realizing as I was in there was that I was relieved my kids were gone. I was glad they were gone because I couldn't take care of them. You know, I never could get them to daycare on time, and then I'd have them for the rest of the day. And I, you know, I would mean to do stuff with them, but once I start drinking, it's over. And I would mean to clean their room, but once I start drinking, it's over. And my kids ate a lot of SpaghettiOs and pizza at 1 and 3 because that's just the best I could do. And I never meant to be horrible to them, but I'm sure I was edgy and intolerant and you know, and what happened to my kids, while I didn't beat them physically, what happened to them is they gradually became invisible in their own home. Because what I told them over and over and over was, I love you, go away. I love you. I don't want to play. Go play with your sister. Pick up your toys, you know. Get away from me. Of course I love you, honey. And those kids just disappeared. Because if they were talking to me, I was so far into my own head, I didn't even hear them, you know. I was just looking right through them. And I knew they were better off at my mom's house, where on a daily basis they were getting to daycare on time and clean clothes. They got age-appropriate food at dinner time. She read them a story every night. They went to bed on clean sheets every night with a bath. You know, I couldn't do any of that, and I hated her for doing it, let me tell you. I made her life miserable at every turn. I was the kind of daughter who, when I would have my kids on the occasional rare weekend, would talk to them about how we were going to get an apartment pretty soon. You know, knowing it wasn't true, but knowing that they would go home excited and that Grandma would have to talk them down. You know, that's the kind of daughter I am when I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. And while I was in treatment, I got a phone call on the 10th day, and my father had died suddenly. And I was devastated because I was going to go, I don't know how to be Beth. I was going to go be Jim's daughter in AA, you know, and now I can't do that. And I was the only child of divorced parents, so I got the insurance money. And bottom line is, it let me drink the way I wanted to drink for the next 2.5 years. And the kids stayed at my mom's, and I just drank. And by the end of 1987, I was tired. The checkbook was tired. You know, I couldn't even pay my little apartment rent. I moved into a friend's house. I said for years that I moved into an attic apartment, and it occurred to me a couple years ago I didn't move into an attic apartment. I moved into an attic. It was an apartment after I got there. And, you know, I just, at 28 years old, I would wake up in November. It's real gray in the Midwest in November, and I would wake up at 5:30 and not know if it was a.m. or p.m. And, you know, I just couldn't bear the thought of getting up to the bar and finding out it was 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, because I didn't have enough money to drink all day, and I would think, oh, I'll go back to sleep, and when I wake up, it'll be lighter, it'll be dark, and then I'll know. And I would toss and turn for what seemed like hours, and I would wake up at 5:45, and it would be gray, you know. And the kids would come over for a weekend occasionally, but I wasn't a mom to them, you know. They pretty much sat and watched TV while I sat and drank and watched TV, and that's just all I had. And somewhere early in 1988, I just kind of hit a wall with it all and said, God, I can't live like this anymore. You have got to help me. And I remembered that big book that my dad had sent me. And I went and found it because I'd been in this attic since August, but I hadn't unpacked. I just had a path from, like, the couch to the TV to the bed. So I dug through a box and found out that book that my dad had sent me. And I still had it because it was a hardcover. I always tell new people, get a hardcover book. They're harder to throw away. And I read Bill's story, you know, because I'd been through treatment twice by this time. And they tell you the design for living and the directions and all that crap's in the book, you know. But I would open up to page one every time because I figure if they really wanted you to read the Roman numerals, they would have started that at page one. You know, that was just for people who like to read. And so I would open up to page one, Bill's story, looking for the directions, and it would say war fever ran high in a New England town, and I would think, oh, yeah, this is real helpful, you know. I'm screwed. But that night I read Bill's story, and I did, because, you know, the other thing is I would read it and think, who cares? He's old. He lived in the 30s. He was a stockbroker. He was a man. You know, what's this got to do with me? And that night I read Bill's story, and I identified with how he felt and what happened to him. And you know, now I know that Bill's story is just a speaker meeting in print that they put at the front of the book so that somebody maybe could identify and keep reading. And the next day I felt strangely relieved. You know, I didn't really want to drink. And I had felt like that on a couple other occasions. And in hindsight, I know that, you know, any time I asked God for help, it was there, you know. But I never followed through with any of it. I never did anything to stay surrendered once I surrendered. And you know, surrendering really isn't such a trick around here. It's painful sometimes. But, you know, staying surrendered when you start to feel better is the hard part. And that day, the voices started and just said, oh, you know, you're going to drink. You may as well, you know. And I really didn't want to. But once I took, you know, once I take the drink, then it's on because the physical thing kicks in. And I drank on and off for the next 6 months, more off than on. And in June of 1988, I had this sudden thought that I'd been gone from Florida 4 years, and I bet they were all sitting down there going, God, I wish Beth would come back. And I took my mom's credit card, because, of course, I had nothing, and I took off to Florida, one-way ticket, never coming back, you know. And at the end of a week, I was tired, and the credit card was tired, and, you know, nothing was going well, And I went to book a plane ticket home, and the credit card would not bear the weight of the plane ticket. So on June 26, 1988, I was in the Fort Myers, Florida airport, And I didn't even have a dollar. I didn't have enough money for one drink. And if I'd have had enough money for one drink, somebody else would be standing here, because I can get the second one if I can get the first one. But I couldn't bear the thought of being asked to leave, because it would have been obvious I'd been sitting in the bar looking for somebody to buy me a drink. And I thought about stealing some little old lady's purse, because there's a lot of retired people in Florida, but I felt so bad, you know, just one of those hangovers. And I knew I'd pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week. And she'd run me down and take her purse back, and I'd look bad. So I called my mom, and she said, I don't know, call me back later. I don't know what I'm going to do. And when I called back, she said, I've booked a plane ticket for you, but you need to understand, I'm not flying you home. I'm flying the children's mother home, and it's only because we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And so on June 26, 1988, I got on an airplane back to Cincinnati. I hadn't had a drink all day, and I had no idea that was going to be my sobriety date, you know, no idea. And she picked me up at the airport at 1 o'clock in the morning, and she pulled in at the local detox center to drop me off. And I, you know, she hadn't mentioned that part of the deal when she booked a plane ticket. And I was not amused, but she said, go in or don't. But I have done everything I can do for you. You're going to have to do it. And I'm leaving, and you can go in or not go in, but I'm leaving and you're not coming with me. And, you know, I told that story for a lot of years before I realized what it cost her to have to do that. You know, I'm the only child, and that was a horrible section of town. And I can't imagine what it takes to leave your only child on a doorstep somewhere and just say, I can't help you. You know, but thank God she did, because when I was finally accountable, when there was nobody left that I could try to manipulate into doing it for me, I had to do it myself. And I went into detox, and the next day I'm laying there in that detox bed, and I was 29 and a half years old, and I was trying to figure out, you know, come up with a plan, because we always got a plan. And I was surveying my life, and I had my car was impounded, and I had charges pending, and I didn't know what they were, but I figured they had something to do with the car being impounded, and I wasn't sure I was welcome in my attic apartment, that wasn't really new stuff. I had been there before, but what was different on that day was I didn't have an idea about what to do about any of it. I did not have one place to turn. I didn't have one idea. Well, you could get a job here. No, you can't. You could borrow. No, you can't. I mean, my sponsor calls it no friendly direction, you know? And I realized that I had never really thought I would live to be 30, you know? I mean, I should have been dead over and over and over. And I mixed drugs and alcohol. I drove drunk for years. I rode motorcycles when I couldn't walk. I hung out with people who were not very nice. I bartended in places where people shot at each other. You know, I just should have been dead over and over and over. And the only reason I never tried to kill myself is I knew I would live. You know, I knew I would live and probably be maimed and look bad. You know, a friend of mine tried to kill himself when I was 7 months sober. And the problem is some of us don't die. And he was paralyzed on the right, 39 years old, paralyzed down the right side on a drug-induced stroke because he tried to overdose and didn't die. I'm in that bed, and I'm 29 and a half with no plans for post-30 living because I just never thought I'd be there. And I realized that I was distressingly healthy. You know, there was nothing wrong with me. My blood pressure was even low. I mean, there was just nothing wrong with me, and I realized that I was going to live, and that scared me to death, you know. Diane would have been fine. If you had told me, Beth, if you leave here today and get a beer, you'll be dead in 6 months, I would have gotten the beer. Trust me, you know. But I knew that day I was going to live to be 40 or 50 or 60 or 70 or 80, drinking or not drinking, and that no matter how bad things were right then, there were levels of worse that I hadn't seen and couldn't imagine. You know, I mean, I still, even where I was, most of my limbs functioned. You know, I realized there was a lot more to lose before it was the bottom, and that scared me. Now, those of you who've heard Chuck talk, you know, he came in for the opposite reason. He knew, he got here the day before he died. You know, he knew if he took a drink, he was a dead man. So it doesn't even matter why you come, afraid to die or afraid to live, you know, because we're on both ends of that. It just doesn't matter. And the thought of living 30 or 40 or 50 more years scared me to death. And I just had this passing thought that, well, whatever those AA people are doing seems to be working for them. And clearly what I'm doing is not working for me. Maybe I should try it their way. And I had no idea that that was going to be the surrender. You know, I mean, I was a biker, for God's sakes. I thought I'd go out in a blaze of glory, you know, down in flames. And, you know, apparently my big blaze is just this little tiny voice that just says, oh, screw it, you know. And I just turned myself into AA. And I got out of detox on Friday at 4th of July weekend. And I couldn't get to my car till Tuesday. And I had plans to interview to stay at this hotel for women. That should have been a sign of surrender right there. And I couldn't get in there till Tuesday. And I scraped up. I knew if I went where I lived, I would drink. I knew that. So I scraped up a little money, and I found a cheap hotel room right on the bus line in Cincinnati that I just had to walk out the door of the hotel, get on the bus, ride it about a mile and a half, and I would be at the AA clubhouse. And that was absolutely all I could manage. And I almost didn't go the first day because, well, hey, I've been going to meetings for 5 days. You know, I could take a day off. But this voice in my head said, you skip meetings before and you drank. So I got on the bus and I went to the meeting. And the woman who was speaking at the meeting that night had 4 years of sobriety. I had met her in 1984 when I was passing through. And she said something that just changed my life because she said, you know, she's sitting in a room full of people at a Friday night meeting at Oak Street in Cincinnati. It was probably 200 people. And she said that alcoholism took her to the place where she didn't want to work and she didn't want to care for her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And I had never heard anyone say they didn't want to care for their child because that was my biggest secret. That was the one I couldn't ever tell anybody because what kind of person are you if you don't even want your kids? And, I mean, periodically through those couple of years, I would quit drinking every now and then. But a lot of guilt can creep in 24 hours if you're, like, not drinking with no solution. And my head would be almost to the pillow, and those voices would start again and say, yeah, but you don't even want your own kids, Beth. What is, you know, tell that to your friends and see how that flies. Because I would tell you, oh, of course I want them back. You know, I'm just having a little difficulty right now. But the bottom line was I was glad they were gone. And my biggest fear when I got sober was that I would never be able to love them. I didn't know if alcoholism had permanently robbed me of the capacity to even love my kids. I just didn't know. And I got here, and I went to the meeting, and there she was saying she didn't want to care for her daughter. And so I got her phone number, and the next day I called her. And it took half an hour because I would just think, oh, she's busy, you know. And she didn't really want you to call. She's just being nice. Or my biggest fear, she might say, Beth, who, you know. And I finally called her after half an hour, and I just said, you know, I got your number last night. I have no idea what to say. I am just practicing using the phone. And she just laughed and said, that's what I had to do. You know, because I don't know how to have phone conversation any more than I know how to have a face-to-face conversation. So I tell new people, when you call me, just tell me you're practicing. You know, I'll know what you mean. We're just not going to have deep philosophical conversations at 3 and 4 days sober. And hopefully. So I started calling this woman, and I started going to a meeting every day because I wasn't sure if I was going through a halfway house or not, but I couldn't get in for a month. So I made a commitment to go to a meeting every day. And I started going to this clubhouse, and I went to a Big Book meeting every day, and then I would go to a speaker meeting at night. And I'll talk about the Big Book meeting in a minute. But one of the things that happened when I was a week out of detox that very next Friday, well, two things happened that first week. You know, one, I showed up a lot. And the second night I went there, I sat, like, in the second row because I knew, you know, if you're new, you sit in the back, and we know you're new. And when you're in the front, you have to talk to people. So I sat in the second row, you know, and I sat over at this particular clubhouse. The chairs went right up to the wall on one side. So I sat on that, you know, so now I maybe only have to talk to one person, right? And so I go through the meeting, and it's time to say the Lord's Prayer. I have no hand to hold over here because there's a wall. And I am thinking, you know, everybody starts up in my head again. What a loser. You can't even say the Lord's Prayer right, you know. You are just never going to fit in here. And I hooked my thumb in my pocket, and I just hung my head to say the prayer alone, you know. And somebody in front of me in that front row turned around and took my hand. And I can't tell you the relief just the touch of another person brought me. And I wouldn't have told you I was looking for that. You know, but they're the reason I can't. I was so relieved that someone included me, and I just started to cry through the first, and then I had to spend the second half of the prayer trying to stop crying, you know, because I'm tough broad. We can't be seen crying at prayers. And but, you know, I've never found out who that was that took my hand, but they are the reason I came back on Sunday. You know, we talk about 12-stepping and sponsoring a lot of times, but, you know, I mean, there's more to 12-step work than 12-step calls. You know, remembering a new person's name is so integral. God, I just wanted you to know who I was. You know, but I couldn't even ask for it. I didn't know that's what I wanted. I thought the opposite. I thought I didn't want you anywhere near me. So how can I, you know, how can I ask to be included? Because I don't think I even, you know how we are when we're new, you know. I don't need you. I don't like you. Why aren't you talking to me? And or my personal favorite, you know, help me. And I came back the next day, and I just started showing up. And so the next Friday, they were passing the basket at this Friday night meeting because a member of that group's 9-year-old daughter had been killed by a drunk driver that day. And you know, the next Tuesday, he was in this big book meeting that I'd been going to, and I couldn't believe he was at a meeting 4 days after his daughter had been killed. But he was talking about it. And in Cincinnati, if you get a drunk driving ticket, you have to go somewhere called Drake Hospital to do your 3-day court thing. And this happened right outside Drake Hospital. You know, these two cars were drag racing on Galbraith Road and hit the car she was in head on. She was killed instantly. And the people who were there doing their court weekend were outside on a smoke break when it happened. And he said, maybe one of them saw that and will get sober. You know, I have to believe it wasn't for nothing. And I was mulling that over when I left, and I thought, what if my kids had been in that car? What would they remember about me? Because, you know, my word was worth nothing. I didn't show up when I was supposed to. I made promises I couldn't keep. And what if that had been them? Or what if I had been in that car? What kind of memory would they have of their mother? And I just, this feeling just came over me, which I know now is probably the first gratitude I ever felt. And I realized I'd been given a second chance and that sobriety really was a gift. And trust me, gift and AA is not words I ever used in the same sentence, you know. But it was like I could go call my kids right now with no strings attached and just tell them I love them. You know, no do-overs, not to erase everything, but that I could start from right where I was on that day and build a relationship with them from there as a sober mom. And that if I was a weekend mom forever, that was okay too. I could be a good weekend mom and that it would be all right. And, you know, that was a turning point for me. And a year later, I got to share that with that guy. I got to tell him how much my life changed that day when he said that. So anyway, I'm going to these big book meetings. Now, I went to the big book meetings for a couple of reasons. One, it was at noon, so I had my whole day free. Two, I know you're supposed to read the book every day, and I thought that would count. And three, they read a whole chapter, so it chewed up like half of the hour, so odds were better that I wouldn't get called on to share, which I now know were not real good odds anyway, but I didn't know that then. And I don't know why they wouldn't want to hear my experience, Strength and Hope, with a week. my interpretation of the big book. Anyway, so that I didn't go to learn about the book and get sober. I went for those reasons. But God has a wonderful sense of humor, you know. And, yeah, my day was free at 1, and about 4:30 I would realize I had no life. And, you know, there's really nothing to do. So I did 2 meetings a day a lot because, I mean, what are you going to do? I was a bar drinker. I had to be where people were. And in the book, when you guys read it, I heard it. And when I tried to read at home, I don't know about you, but my brain was sawdust when I was new. And if I tried to read at home, I would either start to read and 20 minutes later I was staring at the same paragraph, or else I'd be 20 pages in and have no idea what I read, you know. And I would try to concentrate on just one. I'm just going to get this paragraph today, just as when I would read it and read it and read it, and I would close the book and it would just be gone, you know. And when you read it, I could stay on the page a little better. Now, not always, you know. I mean, we might be reading along, and I'm reading along, you know. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed, or I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound today, you know. I mean, I couldn't stay all the way there, but I was more there when you read. And I know, you know, just being exposed to all that so much, it started creeping in early. And I always say I know it was seeping in because one day after the noon meeting, I had to run an errand at Walgreens or somewhere. And on the way into the store, I stopped, you know, I kind of popped in to see what we were all talking about because, I mean, they're all there to this day, but I don't check in with them very often. And that day I popped up to see what we were all discussing, you know, because I was still new and stupid. And somebody in my head is going, that was really cool what Guy said at the meeting today. And somebody else is going, yeah, I didn't know that was in the book. Did you? And somebody else is going, well, I didn't know that was in the book. And I just thought, dear God, even the voices in my head are getting sober, you know. Hey, this is good. So I left them up there to have their meeting, and I got out of there. the biggest joke on me about that Big Book meeting was that, unbeknownst to me, people who go to Big Book meetings on purpose tend to read the book and do what it says. You know, and what I was attracted to in that meeting was the laughter. You know, over my years when I was bouncing in and out, I had been to some ever so serious discussion meetings where I thought, if I have to do this one day at a time for the rest of my life, it's not going to be very long. I will blow my brains out. And, you know, there was a lot of laughter in that room because the people in that room read the book, applied it in their life. They did what it said. They worked with other people. And my laziness had plopped me down into the middle of the most active AAs in Cincinnati. You know, I mean, some of them, they were sober forever. I mean, there was people in there with 3 years and 5 years and 8 years sober, you know. I mean, just forever. And I just fell in with them. And I think I was about 3 weeks sober. And one of them said, Beth, you've been around before. Why don't you write an inventory? And I thought, yeah, why not? You know, I didn't know I could say I wasn't ready. And I just, you know, and so I wrote it as it's outlined in the Big Book. And the woman who did not want to care for her daughter had become my first sponsor. And I shared my fifth step with her. And that, you know, I was out making amends. And my life took off. You know, I have never looked back. I am so grateful that I didn't run into somebody who thought you should work a step a year, you know, because I could not have gone anything like 6 months or a year without unloading all that stuff that was in my head. And, you know, from that day to this, I really have never not been in AA. You know, I have been in the middle from then to now. And, you know, those kids, when I was a year, one of the things that happened with my kids when I'd had that epiphany that I could start to build a relationship with them, one of the first amends I made to them was to stop making promises I couldn't keep. You know, and I was very careful through that whole first sober summer. I would make one promise to one kid and I would keep it. And I would make one promise to one kid and I would keep it. You know, my son was six. He wanted to go to a Reds game. You know, it's July of 1988. It's the week it was 105 all week long. That, of course, is the day we go to the afternoon ball game. It was a three-hit game. The score was 1-0 at the end of the second or third inning, and it stayed, you know, by seven innings. I'm thinking, this is where you drink, isn't it? You know? But we just ate one of everything. You know, it became a game with us. We walked every level of the stadium, and it was like, what should we eat next, Mommy? I don't know, you know. And I mean, that's just kind of a special thing for us to this day. He's going to turn 26 in January, and we still kind of have a joke about Reds baseball games, you know, and that has become a special memory. It's something that started out as making an amend. And when I was a year sober, my mom and I talked and decided there really wasn't a point to them coming to live with me at a year sober, because they had been with her for 4 years by then. She lived in an excellent school district in a safe neighborhood. They had stable lives. They were now in like kindergarten and second grade, and they'd had the same friends since daycare. And, you know, they were doing what they were supposed to do. I was the disruption in their lives, not anything they were doing. And it didn't make sense to pull them out of that clean, safe, stable environment to bring them to my 10th floor efficiency in a crummy section of town. And so we agreed that they would stay with her and I would catch up to them, you know. And they came on a lot of weekends, and they came to a lot of meetings. I used to say, you know, my kids did four meetings a week. I never really bought it when people told me they couldn't get to meetings. And it was great bringing them to meetings because Sarah, the four-year-old, could remember everybody's name, which was very helpful since I couldn't. She's a good one to have around. But, you know, you guys taught me how to talk to my kids. I'm not an intuitive parent to this day. I mean, my first thought is generally, yes, but what about me? You know, but bringing those kids to the meeting, you guys taught me how to talk to them. When they came in, you sat down on a chair so you could look them in the eye and talk to them. You called them by name. You remembered if they had a soccer game last weekend. You colored with them. You asked them to help you get coffee cups. They became part of AA with me. And they looked forward to coming to meetings. And their gaze came up off the ground. And they began to look the world in the eye. And that's because you all talk to my kids. You know, and I try to remember that when I see small children now. Just, you know, same deal. Remember their name, you know. And we kept coming to meetings. And a couple of things happened I like to tell. I'll try to tell quickly. One is when I was about a year sober, we went to a picnic and, you know, we got there and there's kids playing. And I said, if you want to go play, you can. And they never went and played, which was fine. You know, they didn't live with me and they liked to hang out with me. But that day, about half an hour later, Robbie's tugging on my leg and he said, Mom, I just wanted to let you know if you need us that we're over here playing. And I realized, you know, because that's all fine, but sometimes it's like God picks up the curtain and I get a peek at what's going on. And what I realized was that was the day they knew they could let me out of their sight and I would be there when they got back. And that took a year. You know, that took a very long time. But they relaxed enough that they knew they could go play and I would be there. And life was getting good. By 15 months sober, this is one of my, you know, give the newcomers hope things. By 15 months sober, I want you to know that I had a driver's license, a car, and insurance all at the same time. I never could get more than 2 out of 3 going. They all had my name on them, too. So, like, you know, I got a little job, a little apartment, a little car. I'm hanging out with my little kids, and I'm looking at my little son, and he's got all these women in his life, you know, my mom and me and his sister. And I'm thinking a 7-year-old little guy like that, he needs a man in his life. And for his sake, I probably should start looking around, you know. Hey, that's the kind of loving, giving mom I am. And we went to the Thanksgiving Day thing at 405 Oak Street, which is a clubhouse in Cincinnati. And I went to the noon Big Book meeting because that's what I do if it's noon and there's a Big Book meeting. And when I came out, I couldn't find Robbie. And somebody said, oh, they're across the street. And at that time, it's gone now. But at that time, there was a schoolyard across the street from the AA clubhouse. And there was my son and another 7-year-old and 4 of the guys from Oak Street playing football. And I just had this thought, like, where else should a 7-year-old boy be on Thanksgiving Day except playing football with a bunch of guys? You know, but the real curtain peeker for me was realizing that I did nothing to make that happen except go to my noon meeting. You know, that if I did AA, that their needs would be met. You know, and for whatever reason, that stuck with me. And I called off the manhunt for a while. Now, I had met Chuck almost a year before. He got sober out in the suburbs, and he didn't really start coming into Oak Street till I was about a year and a half sober, and the first time I ever saw him, he had a year, and which I really like being 6 months ahead of him, by the way, I have to say. I don't know, maybe does that petty thing go away at 20 or no? Sorry. But anyway, he had a year sober. I'd never seen him before, so I'm thinking, I knew everybody, you know, so I'm thinking, wow, who's this guy? And then he gave this talk, I mean, just this great talk, and I always tell him, you know, I just thought to myself, you know, I want what he has, and I am willing to go to any lengths to get it. But we actually didn't date for another year after that. We ran in different crowds, and we would cross paths periodically, but we really didn't start hanging out for another year. And when we did, you know, like I said before, we got to know each other. We kept our clothes on. We didn't change all our meetings to get all our meetings together, you know. He had a sponsor, I had a sponsor, and we included each other in our lives instead of becoming each other's lives. And as we got serious, we agreed that we should never be first in each other's lives, you know, that we needed to be third, that God had to be first and AA had to be second, or we had nothing anyway. And we have tried to live that way, although, I say, you know, on a good day, Chuck's third if I'm not thinking about me. Fourth isn't bad, I don't think. Anyway, we hung out, and he asked me to marry him, and we set a wedding date pretty far out, really about a year and a half. And as the day grew near, we wanted more and more to be married. We didn't go through that breakup, get back, you know. We had a goal, and we worked for the goal. And in July, we were married 15 years. And that's, you know, I always say in AA, we should get to counting dog years, because 90 days is pretty long term for us. So if somebody says, how long have you been married? We say 105 years. But, you know, we're still having a good time, and we still like each other. I mean, that's a big, not only are we in love, but we like each other. You know, we like to hang out, and we value these weekends when we get to be in the same place at the same time, because there's a lot of weekends that we're not, you know. But AA is first, and God's above that, and that's just what we do. You know, this is where we're useful. This is where I got a sense of purpose that I didn't even know I was looking for. And sometimes I forget to let you know that we did, in fact, get the children. We got custody of the children. We moved into a neighborhood near them, and 2 years later, we moved into their neighborhood. And about then, Chuck got his college degree, and he had a job with insurance, which was kind of the last missing piece. And in 1993, we signed custody of the kids back to us, and they walked out the front door of their parents' home to start school like everybody else in fifth and seventh grade. And that was a happy day. We handed out candy at our home group. It's a boy, it's a girl, you know. We'd only been married a year, so people said, "Are you having kids?" And we're like, "Yeah, they're 11 and 13. Isn't it cool?" And we had some rough times because we got these cute little kids back, but we had not counted on them turning into teenagers. And turned out our son's probably the kindred spirit. And we had some hard years with that boy. I mean, there were a couple years where we didn't know if we would ever all sit as a family in the same room again. It just was horrible. But we kept God in the front, and then AA, and then each other. And we got through it one day at a time. And we ended up for a while. We had both kids in the Army. Now our son's out of the Army. And you know what? We moved to North Carolina right at the beginning of 2003 to take a job. And our son was in the Army or getting ready to swear in when we moved. And when he got out of the Army, he moved to Raleigh. You know, he lives 10 miles away from us now. And I mean, we never thought he would even be in the same state again. And our daughter's still in the Army. She's in Fort Hood, Texas. She is a beautiful young woman. She's been married for about a year and a half and I guess closer to 2 years now, and presented us with our first granddaughter on the 4th of July. This poor child was born on 4th of July on an Army base. She will probably be getting red, white, and blue cards for the rest of her life. But although we did say, there's an upside to this because you won't have to give her a birthday party till she's about 8. Just take her to the park, you know. Look, honey, parades and balloons, all for you. But we're having fun being grandparents, even though we're way too young to be this old, you know. And what a life. I could not have dreamed this life. I mean, I couldn't have told you when I walked through the doors of AA that I would be hanging out in Virginia Beach, you know. Or that we would be, when we moved to North Carolina, we realized Pinehurst was like 60 miles away and we were just learning how to play golf and the U.S. Open was coming to town and we thought, oh, what the heck, let's go, you know. And we went through that we didn't think we'd get tickets really, and then we got the thing, congratulations, you know, we're charging you $8 million next week on your credit card for your tickets and we're still paying for those. But anyway, we went down to the U.S. Open and we're walking around on Thursday and we're sitting in the grandstand. I'm sorry for you non-golfers, but golfers will understand this. And so we're in the grandstands on the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2. And we're watching the golfers come in. And all of a sudden we looked at each other because we realized that we are sitting in the grandstands on the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2. Now, how the hell do you get there from the Dewdrop Inn, you know? I mean, we just busted out laughing. I mean, what else could we do? I just can't dream this big, you know? And if you're new, I urge you to come back. You know, catch the fever, you know? I was not looking for a relationship with God when I got here because I was kind of like somebody else has already said. I was afraid if I prayed, he would know where I was. And as the result of working these steps, I have found a relationship with God. Because that's what the big book says. The big book says that a spiritual awakening is awareness of the presence of God. So what that says to me is as a result of working the steps, I became aware of the presence of God. And that's been a relationship like any other. You know, it started out, we didn't know each other very well, and it has grown and deepened over the years. And I know from watching my sponsor and the people ahead of me that that will continue. And, you know, God, the only limits on God are the ones that I put there, you know. I never knew the whole time I was out there trying to be the cheerleader, the night otter, Jim and Sally's daughter, that what I was looking for was Beth Hartley, child of God, you know. I didn't know that's what made me fit into my space in the world was Beth Hartley, child of God. And here we sit, this gigantic family reunion of the children of God. Who could dream this big? Thank you.